Phone rang at 2:30 a.m. the morning of April the 24th. Numbly, dumbly, mopingly, gropingly, out of the dark, I find and identify a body, a self, a task.
Goodman,
I say into the receiver, propped up on one arm, still coming a long way back.
Bombing and homicide,
the electrically unicoid voice in the transmitter tells me. I sleep naked, sorry about that, and I'm putting on my drawers and trousers as I copy the address. East 68th Street, near the Council on Foreign Relations.
Moving,
I say, hanging up.
What is...
Rebecca mumbles from the bed. She's naked too. And that recalls very pleasant memories of a few hours earlier. I suppose some of you will be shocked when I tell you I'm past 60, and she's only 25. It doesn't make it any better that we're married, I know. This isn't a bad body for its age. And seeing Rebecca, most of the sheets thrown aside, reminds me just how good it is. In fact, at this point, I don't even remember having been the ringmaster, or what echo I retain is confused with sleep and dream. I kiss her neck unselfconsciously, for she is my wife. And I am her husband. And even if I am an inspector on the homicide squad, Homicide North to be exact, any notions about being a stranger in this body have vanished with my dreams into air, into thin air.
What?
Rebecca repeats, still more asleep than awake.
Damn fool radicals again,
I say, pulling on my shirt, knowing any answer is as good as another in her half-conscious state. She says, satisfied, and turns over into deep sleep again. I washed my face somewhat, tired old man watching me from the mirror, and ran a brush through my hair, just time enough to think that retirement was only a few years away, and to remember a certain hypodermic needle and a day in the Catskills with my first wife, Sandra, back when they at least had clean air up there. Socks, shoes, tie, fedora. And you never stopped mourning. As much as I loved Rebecca, I never stopped mourning Sandra. Bombing and homicide. What a Michigan world. Do you remember when you could at least drive in New York at 3 a.m. without traffic jams? Those days were gone. The trucks that were banned in the daytime were all making their deliveries now. Everybody was supposed to pretend the pollution went away before dawn. Papa used to say,
Saul, Saul, they did it to the Indians, and now they're doing it to themselves. Goyoshinaras!
He left Russia to escape the pogrom of 1905, but I guess he saw a lot before he got out. He seemed like a cynical old man to me then, and I seem like a cynical old man to others now. Is there any pattern or sense in any of it? The scene of the blast was one of those old office buildings with Gothic and gingerbread styling all over the lobby floor. In the dim light of the hour, it reminded me of the shadowy atmosphere of Charlie Chan in the Wax Museum. And a smell hit my nostrils as soon as I walked in. A patrolman, lounging inside the door, snapped to attention when he recognized me.
"Took out the 17th floor and part of the 18th,
he said.
"Also a pet shop here on the ground level. Some freak of dynamics. Nothing else is damaged down here, but every fish tank went. That's the smell."
Barney Muldoon, an old friend with the look and mannerisms of a Hollywood cop, appeared out of the shadows. A tough man, and nowhere as dumb as he liked to pretend, which is why he was head of the bomb squad.
"Your baby, Barney?"
I asked casually.
"Looks that way. Nobody killed. The call went out to you because a clothier's dummy was burned on the 18th floor and the first car here thought it was a human body."
"Wait. George Dawn is screaming." Saul's face showed no reaction to the answer. But poker players at the Fraternal Order of Police had long ago given up trying to read that inscrutable Talmudic countenance. As Barney Muldoon, I knew how I would feel if I had the chance to drop this case on another department and hurry home to a beautiful bride like Rebecca Goodman. I smiled down at Saul. His height would keep him from appointment to the force now, The rules were different when he was young. And I added quietly,
"There might be something in it for you, though."
The fedora darked as Saul took out his pipe and started to fill it. All he said was,
"Oh? Right now,"
I went on,
"we're just notifying missing persons. But if what I'm afraid of is right, it'll end up on your desk after all."
He struck a match and started puffing.
"Somebody missing at this hour might be found among the living in the morning,"
he said between drags. The match went out, and shadows moved where nobody stirred.
"And he might not, in this case,"
Muldoon said.
"He's been gone 3 days now. An Irishman your size can't be any more subtle than an elephant,"
Saul said wearily.
"Stop tantalizing me. What do you got?" "The office that was hit,"
Muldoon explained, obviously happy to share the misery,
"was a magazine called Confrontation. It's a kind of left of center, so this was probably a right-wing job and not a left-wing one. But the interesting thing is, we couldn't reach the editor, Joseph Malik, at his home. And when we called one of the associate editors, what do you think he told us? Malik disappeared 3 days ago. His landlord confirms it. He's been trying to get a hold of Malik himself because there's a no-pets rule there, and the other tenants are complaining about his dogs. So, if a man drops out of sight and then his office gets bombed, I kind of think the matter might come to the attention of the homicide department eventually, don't you?"
So granted.
"Might and might not," he said. "I'm going home. I'll check with missing persons in the morning, see what they got."
The patrolman spoke up.
"You know what bothers me most about this? The Egyptian mouth breathers."
"The what?"
Saul asked.
"That pet shop,"
the patrolman explained, pointing to the other end of the lobby.
"I looked over the damage, and they have one of the best collections of rare tropical fish in New York City. Even Egyptian mouth breathers."
He noticed the expressions on the faces of the two detectives and added lamely,
"If you don't collect fish, you wouldn't understand. But believe me, an Egyptian mouth breather is pretty hard to get these days. And they're all dead in there."
"Mouth breather?"
Muldoon asked incredulously.
"Yeah, you see, they keep their young in their mouths for a couple of days after birth, and they never, never swallow them. That's one of the great things about collecting fish. You get to appreciate the wonders of nature."
Muldoon and Saul looked at each other.
"It's inspiring,"
Muldoon said finally,
"to have so many college graduates on the force these days."
The elevator door opened, and Dan Pricefixer, a red-headed young detective on Muldoon's staff, emerged carrying a metal box.
"I think this is important, Barney,"
he began immediately, with just a nod to Saul.
"Damned important. I found it in the rubble and had been partly blown open, so I looked inside." "And?"
Muldoon prompted.
"It's the freakiest bunch of inter-office memos I ever set eyes on. Weird as tits on a bishop."
"This is going to be a long night," Saul thought suddenly with a sinking feeling. "A long night and a heavy case."
"Want a peek?"
Muldoon asked him maliciously.
"You better find a place to sit down,"
Pricefixer volunteered.
"It'll take you a while to go through them." "Let's use the cafeteria,"
Saul suggested.
"You just have no idea,"
the patrolman repeated,
"the value of an Egyptian mouth breather."
"It's rough for all nationalities, man or fish,"
Muldoon said in one of his rare attempts to emulate Saul's mode of speech. He and Saul turned to the cafeteria, leaving the patrolman looking vaguely distressed. "His name is James Patrick Hennessy, and he's been on the force 3 years. He doesn't come back into this story at all. He had a 5-year-old retarded son whom he loved helplessly. You see 1,000 faces like his on the street every day and never guess how well they are carrying their tragedies. And George Dawn, who once wanted to shoot him, is still screaming. But Barney and Saul are in the cafeteria. Look around. The transition from the Gothic lobby to this room of laminated, functional and glittering plastic colours is, one might say, trippy. Never mind the smell. We're closer to the pet shop here." Saul removed his hat and ran a hand through his grey hair pensively as Muldoon read the first two memos in one quick scan. When they were passed over, he put on his glasses and read, more slowly, in his own methodical and thoughtful way. Hold on to your hats. This is what they said. Illuminati Project Memo 1, 7/23, J.M. The first reference I've found is in Violence by Jacques Ellul, Seabury Press, New York, 1969. He says, pages 18 to 19, that the Illuminated Ones were founded by Joachim of Floris in the 11th century and originally taught a primitive Christian doctrine of poverty and equality, but later, under the leadership of Fra Dolcino in the 15th century, they became violent, plundered the rich, and announced the imminent reign of the Spirit. In 1507, he concludes, they were vanquished by the forces of order, that is, an army commanded by the Bishop of Vercoy. He makes no mention of any Illuminati movement in earlier centuries or in more recent times. I'll have more later today. Pat. P.S. I found a little more about Joachim of Floris in the back files of the National Review. William Buckley and his cronies think Joachim is responsible for modern liberalism, socialism, and communism. They've condemned him in fine theological language. He committed the heresy, they say, of immanentizing the Christian eschaton. Do you want me to look that up in a technical treatise on Thomism? I think it means bringing the end of the world closer, sort of. Illuminati Project Memo 2, 7/23, J.M. My second source was more helpful. Akron Darrow, A History of Secret Societies, Citadel Press, New York, 1961. Darrow traces the Illuminati back to the 11th century also, but not to Joachim of Floris. He sees the origin in the Ismailian sect of Islam, also known as the Order of Assassins. They were vanquished in the 13th century, but later made a comeback with a new, less violent philosophy and eventually became the Ismailian sect of today, led by the Aga Khan. However, in the 16th century in Afghanistan, the Illuminated Ones, Roshinaya, picked up the original tactics of the Order of Assassins. They were wiped out by an alliance of the Mughals and Persians, pages 220 to 223. But the beginning of the 17th century saw the foundation of the Illuminated Ones of Spain, the Alumbrados, condemned by an edict of the Grand Inquisition in 1623. In 1654, the Illuminated Guerinets came into public notice in France. And finally, the part you're most interested in. The Bavarian Illuminati was founded on May Day, 1776, in Ingolstadt, Bavaria, by Adam Weishaupt, a former Jesuit. Documents still extant show several points of resemblance between the German and Central Asian Illuminists, points that are hard to account for on grounds of pure coincidence, page 255. Weishaupt's Illuminati were suppressed by the Bavarian government in 1785. Darrow also mentions the Illuminati of Paris in the 1880s, but suggests it was simply a passing fad. He does not accept the notion that the Illuminati still exists today. This is beginning to look big. Why are we keeping the details from George? Pat. Saul and Muldoon exchanged glances.
Let's see the next one,
Saul said. He and Muldoon read together, Illuminati Project Memo 3, 7/24, J.M. The Encyclopedia Britannica has little to say on the subject, 1966 edition, volume 11, Halicar to Impala, page 1094. Illuminati. A short-lived movement of Republican free thought founded on May Day 1776 by Adam Weishaupt, professor of canon law at Ingolstadt and a former Jesuit. From 1778 onward, they began to make contact with various Masonic lodges, where, under the impulse of A. Knigger, QV, one of their chief converts, they often managed to gain a commanding position. The scheme itself had its attractions for literary men like Goethe and Herder, and even for the reigning dukes of Gotha and Weimar. The movement suffered from internal dissension and was ultimately banned by an edict of the Bavarian government in 1785. Pat. Saul paused.
"I'll make you a bet, Barney,"
he said quietly.
"The Joseph Malik who vanished is the J.M. these memos were written for."
"Sure," Muldoon replied scornfully.
"These Illuminati characters are still around and they got him. Honest to God, Saul," he added. "I appreciate the way your mind usually pole vaults ahead of the facts, but you can ride a hunch just so far when you're starting from nothing."
"We're not starting from nothing,"
Saul said softly.
"Here's what we've got to start with. One."
He held up a finger.
"A building is bombed. Two."
Another finger.
"An important executive disappeared 3 days before the bombing. Already there's an inference, or two inferences. Somebody got him, or else he knew something was coming for him and he ducked out. Now, look at the memos. Point three."
He held up another finger.
"A standard reference work. The Encyclopedia Britannica seems to be wrong about when the Illuminati came into existence. They say 18th century Germany, but the other memos trace it back to, let's see, Spain in the 17th century, France in the 17th century, and then in the 11th century back to Italy and halfway across the world to Afghanistan. So, we've got a second inference. If the Britannica is wrong about when the thing started, they may be wrong about when it ended. Now, put these 3 points and 2 inferences together, and the Illuminati got the editor and blew up his office. Nuts! I still say you're going too fast."
"Maybe I'm not going fast enough,"
Saul said.
"An organization that has existed for a couple of centuries minimum and kept its secrets pretty well hidden most of that time might be pretty strong by now."
He trailed off into silence and closed his eyes to concentrate. After a moment, he looked at the younger man with a searching glance. Muldoon had been thinking, too.
"I seen men land on the moon,"
he said.
"I seen students break into the administration offices and shit in the dean's wastebasket. I've even seen nuns in miniskirts. But this international conspiracy existing in secret for 800 years, it's like opening a door in your own house and finding James Bond and the President of the United States personally shooting it out with Fu Manchu and the 5 original Marx Brothers."
"You're trying to convince yourself, not me, Barney. It sticks out so far that you could break it into 3 pieces and each one would be long enough to goose somebody up in the Bronx. There is a secret society that keeps screwing up international politics. Every intelligent person has suspected that at one time or another. Nobody wants war anymore, but wars keep happening. Why? Face it, Barney. This is the heavy case we've always had nightmares about. It's cast iron. If it were a corpse, all 6 pallbearers would get double hernias at the funeral."
"Well?" Saul prompted.
"Well, we're either going to have to do something or get off the pot, as my sainted mother used to say."